Amnesty International USA has been out at the Sacred Stone Camp near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. You guys were out there in August, and you went back out there last week. Why did you go back out?
So we went out to Standing Rock, both to the Sacred Stone Camp and to the main camp, the Ossetti Sakawin Camp, because we were concerned about reports of militarized police and the types of tactics that were being used against water protectors in places of peaceful protests. And we've reached out to the sheriff and the government with our concerns, which are, you know, protesters and public assemblies should not be considered the enemy, and the command hierarchy needs to make clear to law enforcement that their task is to facilitate and not to restrict peaceful public assembly. When there are then cases where arrests need to be made, those arrests need to be done fully compliant with international human rights law. They need to be done without undue force or violence against water protectors. And then the conditions under which people are held or processed need to be in line with international standards. And those are concerns that we continue to have after our visits to North Dakota. We've seen footage, I think a lot of people have seen footage, of the use of chemical irritants against protectors and people who are in the water. We've also seen the use of militarized style weapons and equipment. And this is, you know, an incredibly remote place, and you have SWAT teams with semi-automatic weapons and, you know, military-style Humvees on a two-lane road. But it is a sort of stark reminder of what, you know, many people who are seeking to exercise their right to peaceful assembly are looking at, which is a heavily militarized police force. So that's the reason we went back out, and those are the concerns we still have, that to remind the government that it's not only their obligation to not violate the right to protest, but in fact it's their obligation to ensure that the right to protest can happen and facilitate that right.
How has the law enforcement out there responded to Amnesty's concerns?
We have had trouble getting direct responses or scheduling meetings with the sheriff of Morton County or getting a response from the government at all. And we've reached out multiple times without response, both in person, physically in person at the sheriff's office, as well as on the phone and via letter and fax and email. And we haven't yet had a response. That's concerning in and of itself. Certainly we know that there's a lot going on and that government offices are always very busy. But when there is a movement of this scale and the concern that at this point is an international level concern as to what's happening there, we would be hopeful that government would be eager to work with human rights groups and monitors to ensure that their actions are in line with human rights standards.
If you don't receive a response and it appears as though this militarized police presence increases or escalates, what recourse does AI have?
Ultimately, the recourse here is to make sure that they understand that the United States in this case is obligated to human rights standards, that we have as a government signed these and ratified these, and we are obligated to that, and that the world is watching, right? It's not just here in the United States, but that the world is watching. And that's the recourse that, you know, we bring as a human rights organization, which is objective documentation of what's happening, reporting and recommendations, and then advocacy pressure to make that happen. I think we're seeing that outside of Amnesty. A lot of people are, you know, really continually and increasingly interested in what's going on, and I think really concerned about what's going on. And that's the type of public pressure we hope to help raise so that elected officials know that they're responsible to that, but that all officials know that they're obligated to these human rights standards.
You mentioned the surveillance that law enforcement is using out there. Can you describe that surveillance?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, I believe, there was temporary flight restriction that was put over broadly the area of the camps a little far north and a little further south.
That's a no-fly zone.
A no-fly zone, yeah. But those types of no-fly zones don't apply to emergency vehicles, which is often interpreted to be any sort of police or authority interaction. What we observed while there was unmarked small aircraft, sort of, you know, two-seater aircraft, constantly circling the camp area. And these, like, they had a tail marking, but they weren't police marked. There was also near-constant helicopter activity, so a helicopter would be constantly circling the camp. At one point, there were three aircraft in the air, just sort of constantly surveilling what was happening. And that's concerning to us as a human rights organization for a number of reasons. Surveillance should be done when necessary. And again, the duty to protect people and to fill out one's obligations as police or authorities is always at the same time held with one's duty to not violate rights, and constant surveillance is a violation of rights when it's undue. And it's unclear why there is constant surveillance happening, or frankly, even who is doing it. But what it does is it creates a chilling effect within communities and also pits communities against each other. Like if you are being constantly surveilled by the police, it's hard not to think that the police see you as an enemy. There's also police vehicles and militarized SWAT vehicles positioned on hills surrounding the area. So not in the camp itself and not in tribal land, but to the north of that and just sort of constantly present, whether it's the local sheriff's vehicle or a SWAT team, militarized, Humvee, just sort of constantly present and pointed at the camp. And when we've seen this in other countries and in our own country at times, like this is used to surveil dissent and to try and close down peaceful protest, and that's really concerning. Also, you have a right not to be constantly surveilled. And again, it has to be like there has to be extraordinary circumstances for that type of surveillance. We've seen this conversation happening in the United States around questions of, you know, telephone tapping and government data. And this is a very tangible example of that type of surveillance where you have, you know, authorities literally circling over the camp in 24-hour planes and having their vehicles pointed at the camp and just sort of being there at all times. And that's deeply concerning to us as a human rights organization. And frankly, it should be deeply concerning to everyone in this country as we continue to have those conversations about your right to privacy and when the government feels that it can disregard that right.
To my way of thinking, there is a big difference between how law enforcement responded to the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge and how it's responding to this situation in North Dakota. What are your thoughts about that?
We don't have a position on the court case that's gone through. Obviously, it's always our obligation as human rights activists to ensure that fair judicial process happens. But it is hard not to look at those situations and see a very different way in the way that law enforcement dealt with a group of explicitly armed people who are occupying a space of land versus this group of people who have, you know, made really incredibly far-reaching efforts to ensure that no one is armed. The police have reported, like, a woman with a weapon or reports of a person doing X. And again, the police obligation to keep the safety is part of that. If there is someone with a weapon, that is a concern that the police should be dealing with. But until that the police actually bring any sort of evidence of that, it is just that. It's a rumor and it's a report. And that, again, is a way to really chill protest or to paint a certain picture of peaceful assembly without that evidence that actually backs it up. And that is concerning.
Well, Tara DeMann, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.